Accession number 17747, Rule 38.
You were saying that perhaps it was the case that your Irish Trappist monk was acting as a liaison officer with the local civil community.
Yes, I think that seems probable, though I can't remember, but certainly Assisi was a huge attraction to all the troops who had ever heard of St. Francis and so on. And the very next day I note that we had a pleasant chat with a Father Gough, an Irish Franciscan who's been out here in Assisi for 6 years. And we walked up the hill and finished off later, an amazing day, by being called out to settle a 9th Royal Fusiliers drunken brawl.
How many Fusiliers were involved?
I wish I could remember, but I can't. Perhaps it's just as well.
What did you actually do?
I really don't know.
Did you have to actually do anything physical?
I certainly didn't. I'm no use in drunken brawls. But I would have thought it was a case. I mean, normally, of course, it would be a case for the military police, but presumably there were no military police forward of sort of army headquarters or thereabouts. I don't know. I can't remember. It must have been a small affair. And the very next day, those of us who were Catholics, went into a mass in Assisi. It was a Saturday, not a Sunday. It was the Feast of St. Clare. And even the Church of England Padre came with me. Heaps of people were in Assisi, rather like a bank holiday at home, with lots of pretty girls and no signs of war. A little girl asked me for some chocolate in church. The next day, Sunday, I went with two battery officers to have a further look at the St. Francis Basilica, which is really rather remarkable. We were shown some murals by Father Gough, and we went up to the castle by a precarious jeep route. Returned to a rocket from the commanding officer for being out so long. Assisi is the loveliest village I've ever seen. And we got a printed address from Sir Oliver Leese, commander of the 8th Army, and I think I've got a copy of that somewhere in my papers, sort of general morale-boosting thank you and look forward to the next battle kind of thing.
Standard senior officer's pep talk.
That's right, yes. And the 14th Monday of August, the joint United States-British invasion of southern France begins. You say it was the 12th. In fact, we probably got the news a little late. I took a gun to 65th Field Regiment for calibration. Why, I don't know. I would go to a conference for intelligence officers at divisional level about our next campaign. The war is looking good, and with help, the Boche will be smashed in Italy in the next attack. But there's great secrecy about all the details.
Do you remember who was at the conference and who addressed it? Or
That sort of conference, I can't speak for this one specifically, but that sort of conference was usually taken by, in the chair, so to speak, by a brigadier with blackboards and what do you call it, projected maps,
yes,
lantern slide sort of things, yes, in those days. But with the most of the talking being done by a staff captain who tended to be an academic type and frequently was a sort of peacetime Oxford don who was in uniform and more donish than military, describing the intelligence situation. That's my general recollection of these eye conferences.
Were they held on a regular and routine basis, or were they ad hoc?
They tended to be ad hoc. I mean, there wasn't a case of doing it every sort of second Monday of the month, anything of that kind. They were called when there was something worth describing, some change in the situation. And the next day we had to pack up because we were moving to an area nearer to the coast. I remember this very well because we set out in the evening at 9:15. And that was in order to try to deceive the Germans up to a point by travelling with the entire regiment of guns deliberately in the dark. And so we had to cross part of the Apennines in pitch dark, and I was on a motorcycle without lights. And civilian lighting was visible as far as the lovely Assisi hillside, but then at a place called Foligno, which was getting near the front, all civilian lights ceased. And nonetheless, there was heaps of traffic, so it was a hellish business on wickedly poor roads with no lights on any side. We were all travelling in the dark.
What sort of speed could you keep up in those conditions?
It could have been only very, very limited.
Walking pace or...?
A bit more than that.
A bit more
than that. But on a motorbike, of course, it was particularly hazardous because your job was to go up and down the column.
Yes.
I must have been very lucky.
Did you lose any vehicles as a result of this?
Not on
watch?
This particular one, no. No, we didn't. Which was miraculous, really, because normal incidents of breakdowns would suggest some loss of vehicles. When it did occur, of course, they were pushed off the road as far as possible, just not to be in the way. We eventually arrived at 16:30, which was quite a long time later, at a site near Macerata, and spent what was left of the day in a complete daze after all this night driving. First thing, as usual, was to set up or see that there was set up a mess. Beautiful countryside, rather like Surrey, which I remember having seen from school camps in 1936 and 1938. I was, of course, not a southerner. I was a Lincolnshire lad. But I had liked the softness of the Surrey countryside and saw echoes of it. And now we can just hear the distant sounds of war. That presumably means heavy guns. So we're getting near.
Had you seen any sign of enemy or friendly air activity?
No. Had we had our convoy in daylight, I suppose we might have done. But by this time, the Germans were not any longer too strong in the air. Already, I think they were showing signs of weakness on that front. The next day, 18th of August, rain comes and swamps everything, including my bivouac. News of the smashing of the German 7th Army in France.
So this must have been, yes, towards the end of... towards the end of August.
18th of August. The RAF are said to have shot up about 3,000 trucks in the Falaise Gap. Massacre, as I called it. And the Germans fall back in disorder towards the Seine. Suddenly, 19th, Saturday, suddenly, without notice, I'm sent on a divisional advance party to a comfortable staging post in Fabriano at 5 Corps headquarters and see some not very encouraging intelligence maps. No more detail.
Who else was in the divisional forward party who went up to Corps?
Well, I can only assume that it would be... be somebody, obviously, from each of the three brigades and somebody from each of the three gunner regiments attached to the brigades. I doubt whether it would be anybody from battalion level, which would have made much greater numbers. I don't know. I can't think why we were sent.
Would there have been anyone from the sappers as well? Or,
that I would have thought I'd take for granted, somebody from the sappers, yeah.
Yes.
somebody possibly from, well, most certainly from Signals. They're really very important in this, more than most people.
What about armour? Did you have armour attached on a normal basis?
At this point, we didn't have armour, no.
So you're just purely an infantry division?
We were an infantry division, yes. That's right, 56 London Infantry Division. It's a curious mixture of military and civilian activity. The next day we packed up again and nobody around, military or civilians, know who we are. And we see bells being rung by two men in an open church tower, just like Quasimodo in Notre Dame, all looking very medieval. Then off again, forward to 46th Division. Of course, 46 and 56 had been together at intervals since Salerno. So we go forward to 46th Division headquarters at Sasso Ferrato, which is our allotted area, and set up an HQ in Valle d'Ossa, a tiny village. It's pleasant being in this skeleton party with Captain Sturge of the Sturge Brothers stockbroking firm and Major Rowan. Very nice, agreeable people, these. When we heard the next day that this was the first time any English had been in this village, and I prepared for the various departments of RHQ, in other words, room allocations and other facilities, surveying, etc., survey, signals, no doubt catering, I can't think who else.
Did you, when you were doing this work of selecting accommodation, was this for domestic purposes as well as operational? Were you choosing billets as well as...
Well, yes, that's right. Indeed, you're absolutely, you're spot on. As the very next sentence says, that I find room for all officers and sergeants in the village. So prospecting for billets was rather important so that time would not be wasted in domestic trivia when the troops arrived. Mm.
This is rather odd because this, of course, was the traditional role and the original role of the quartermaster.
Yes,
centuries earlier. That,
yes. Not so here.
Not so here. Here it was the assistant and intelligence officer.
That's right. And the Captain Sturge and Major Rowan, who were more senior than me, but they were not either quartermasters or adjutants. They were from... presumably picked ad hoc from two of the batteries. One was a troop commander and the other was a battery commander. So we did a little ad hoc team job in a way which appeared to make sense. I mean, the quartermaster was no doubt well occupied looking after
stores,
getting up the stores, clean houses, and at least one pretty girl, I noted. Eventually the regiment come at 2200, and they take ages to settle in. But my plan for RHQ layout is accepted. And so it goes on. Visit the next day headquarters Royal Artillery for maps and air photos, and get a tack party lined up for the next stage. It's our D-Day for approach to Hitler's Gothic line. At least it will be our D-Day, 25th, 26th, which is 3 days hence. But 46th Division are the people more immediately concerned. So you've got two divisions, 46 and 56, waiting to go up into the line.
Operating in tandem?
Yes, we were tended to be partners. Yeah. Whether, presumably, we were a corps put together, or very nearly. It had been 10 Corps under the Fifth Army. The British Corps was 10 Corps. Whether this was that we were 10 Corps here, I don't know. The next day we had a lecture from Donald Sparks. Now, he would be an Army level intelligence officer. We had a lecture from Donald Sparks about the frightful Gothic line defences. and the conference with Maps about the next actions.
Do you recall what he told you about the Gothic Lion and why it was so frightful?
No, no, I don't, mercifully. I can't remember. It would be the obvious, I suppose, which was that the Germans were redoubtable defenders, that they were well dug in, they'd had months and months in which to prepare the defences, as indeed we found out later. I mean, some of them were almost mansions under the ground with pit props and things holding up dugouts, things which, you know, you would not build inside a period of many, many weeks.
And, of course, they'd also been able to choose the ground to...
Of course, defensive ground, that's right. Yes, it wasn't a very promising sort of thing to look forward to, going in on their terms, so to speak.
Was there ever any comparison in these briefings between the German defences, such as the Gothic Lion, and the sort of defences the Germans had built on the Western Front during the First World War, and the Hindenburg Lion? And
I never heard these comparisons made, but when you say this, it obviously strikes a chord. The Germans had a long tradition of doing this, presumably, particularly in the First War rather than the Second. I don't know whether there was any occasion to do it in the Second War in any depth, because the defences presumably were on the coast to stop us landing, and there can't have been pre-prepared lines of defence across France, or were there? I don't know.
Well, in Normandy they did adopt a strategy of digging in and defending to the bitter end under pressure from Hitler, although the commanders on the ground, many of them wanted a more fluid defensive approach. But of course in Italy I get the impression that there were not really very many fluid operations in the sense that they occurred in North Africa, that the Germans did rely upon holding defensive lines one after another.
Well, looking at the geography, of course, it, I suppose, becomes tolerably clear why. And Italy was only about 70 miles across, or 100, and you can do a job there. You can build a Hadrian's Wall, if you like.
And you can man it.
And you can man it. It's not too big, and given that a lot of it in the middle, the Apennine section occupies half of it and is so unwinnable and unfriendly to attackers, you can forget about that and concentrate on near the coast. So we were, the Americans were on, in this case, were on the west coast going up, and we had taken over the east, the Adriatic.
When you had this lecture from Sparks, did he also give an outline of the way in which the line was to be attacked and penetrated? Or was he simply outlining its characteristics?
I think it was too early and premature for that, and I'm not sure anyway it would have been his job. The job of these chaps tended to be descriptive rather than prescriptive.
Yes. So he was just giving you the picture, the yes. situation in the picture.
Yes, as he had no doubt already given it to his bosses at headquarters, and it was for them to decide how to deal with this. But we were certainly getting pretty near active things, because we got our Tommy guns. It's the first time I've mentioned those. I don't know when we had been issued with them, but we got Tommy guns ready on the 24th. of August, ready for the next day.
Had you used one before?
Only in practice, yes. Yes, I had used one, yeah.
What did you think of the Tommy gun as a weapon?
Well, of course, it was a sort of American gangster novelty. It seemed to be light jerry built compared with a proper gun or proper weapon. But not so much so as the Sten later. I can't remember, but it seemed fairly impressive as a way of getting a lot of lead off very quickly. And compared with setting up a Bren, which was much bigger and heavier thing. It had its attraction. You could go forward with it, which Brennan was a bit heavy for that, though it could be done. And the next morning, horrors began to happen, because we found ourselves going through an area for the first time I could remember of deliberately planted minefields. We walked some miles on a fearsome recce, a group of us, and two of our battery sergeant majors were blown up by mines, which is a horrendous thing to experience. Quite obviously it's worse if you're the victim, but to see these things as I did from about 100, 200 yards is horrendous, because the noise is enormous. And to think of a man being in the middle of that, and part of that noise is his leg being blown off, and so on, with clouds of smoke, it is a horrendous thing to witness.
Had you not encountered mines before?
Yes, I had. The chap whose place I took over as assistant adjutant near Salerno had his foot blown off by a mine, but I had not myself been so close to its happening. I'd heard it in the distance, but in these cases, I remember very clearly the, you know, seeing these chaps across a field suddenly go up in a cloud of smoke.
Did they survive?
Oh yes, they survived. They lost legs.
So they were
out,
sent back.
Oh yes, they were out. Yes.
Were these minefields marked?
Oh no.
So they're unmarked minefields.
Unmarked. Oh yeah. They in fact. I put a supplementary sentence. I said mines are all around, open or hidden, including quite visible small plastic ones designed to remove legs. Italian mines, very cheap, small plastic things just lying around in the fields.
The Germans also had a reputation in some parts of Italy for setting up booby traps as deterring.
Oh, indeed, particularly booby-trapping bodies, which was a horrendous thing. Mm. Yes. Mm. Yes, we'd had that from very early on. Then we eventually found a right area to set up our headquarters, and we had a long, tedious journey through thick traffic, crowded lanes back to RHQ in a jeep. And we got ready to move off up to the place we'd been reconnoitring. And then horrors. Late in the day, I was told I had to go to tactical headquarters of the 4th Indian Division. It's the first time I'd come across the Indians. We had the 4th Indian Division and the 8th, I think, in Italy. Yesterday continued at 2 a.m. tomorrow, so to speak, Saturday the 26th of August, moving off at 2 a.m., arriving 6:30, dozing for an hour, and then going forward to the 5th Indian Brigade, part of the 4th Indian Division, which is the one we are going to have to support.
So you're effectively going out of your own...
Yes, flexibility. We were being loaned division, to the 4th Indian Division for a time. I knew we'd met, I'd forgotten when this was, but it comes back now. The 5th Indian Brigade moves well forward with our CO and our TAC party accompanying to the top of a hill. We get settled in with them, but we're conscious, the CO and I, that our guns are too far back to be of much help in this approach to the Gothic line. The Indians had moved forward too quickly for the guns to follow.
What had happened to their own artillery? Did you?
I can't think. I mean, that for some reason they must have been left behind or transferred to, or something.
What impression did you get of the 5th Indian Brigade and the people in the headquarters?
I can remember nothing specific about them, but. I mean, they were very good. I mean, I've since found a civil service colleague who was in fact with them, and he had a high opinion of the outfit, and to judge by him, they must have been a pretty competent lot. Whether there was any difference between the 4th Indian Division and the 8th, I've no idea. Whether one was more highly regarded than the other.
Did you manage to get your guns forward to positions where they could give support?
I'm trying to see as quickly as I can. Sunday the 27th, we move still on a still further long advance up onto 3,000 foot high hills in White Scout Car, that useless vehicle, which...
Did half track.
Well, it didn't have. I mean, some of them got half tracks, but ours just had tyres. It's a thing that had always been slipping into the mud.
Yes.
When I, Colonel McCracken got so furious with me not being able to reach him. But 3,000 feet up, the best view I've ever seen, a tremendous gorge and a tiny river along its base. Spent the night in a model plantation of tomatoes. Whiskey with a CO under a tarpaulin before turning in. 28th Monday, wake up in fresh mountain air, the climate is perfection. Move off at 1300 hours, following the Sikhs, who are going at great speed, and the Gurkhas too. Obviously, they had a Gurkha brigade or battalion. Well, it would be a battalion, wouldn't it?
Because so were you actually with the Ford Observation Party then, going forward with
Must them? Have been, yes. Yes. Must have been. Make a perilous descent of the valley in scout car. Wait by the river for 2 hours. We are recalled. That's the reason for doing this, was because we were recalled to RHQ from the Ford position because our guns were out of reach. There's
so
nothing we could do.
Too far back.
Too far back. We couldn't use them. So we went back to RHQ to try to make some sense of the situation.
Now, what was the ground like then when you say that you were on top of a ridge and you slept the night in a patch of tomatoes, and then in the morning you got up and you were driving down with the infantry, keeping in touch with them, down into the valley of the little river, and then you were recalled because the guns couldn't actually reach.
Right.
What sort of, do you remember what sort of, what the ground, was it, what was the hillside cultivated?
Yes, it would be one of these wonderful Umbrian, like the Tuscan olive-groved hillsides where the ground is not a rugged mountain, but is quite high, gentle hills, which I can see in retrospect that it was probably quite difficult and a long job to get the guns up, simply because of the inadequacy of the roads. Too hilly to go across any sort of open country, and yet too ill-served by roads to do a major job of moving 24 guns and limbers and quads forward.
And what sort of formation were the infantry in? You mentioned they were moving forward fast, the Sikhs and the Gurkhas.
Yeah.
Were they... Do you recall how they were actually formed for this?
No, I don't. I'm not even sure that I know what you mean when you say what sort of formation. I mean, as far as we as humble gunners were concerned, I mean, they just shoved forward. We could see them, you know, in some cases going forward in vehicles, sometimes walking up hills, marching up hills in open order. But by and large, they would be going forward by... In sort of leapfrogs, as one lot made sure that it was clear to go, another lot would go through them, and
leapfrogging forward
by degrees, the whole lot would be forward.
When they did this leapfrogging, did you know what sort of bound would they cover?
It depends on the terrain. Presumably, they would go forward to the next visible piece of hill. Peak of hill before seeing what was the other side, then going over that. I'm sure they were on roads rather than open countryside. It couldn't have been so quick if they'd been on foot. It was certainly not vehicle country.
Sounds as though they were still moving up rather than actually deploying.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Contact.
It sounds as though the Germans were pulling back into their main defence positions, and this was a bit of forward toying with us as we move forward. They pulled back.
Was there any shellfire coming from the German side? Or
there's no mention
reaction?
Of it, and I would have mentioned if we had been under bombardment, because I didn't like that at all, and there's no mention of it. But it,